the speakers introduce themselves very briefly because we don't have our chair. Our chair is not here. So my name is Ruth Meyerowitz, and I'm a professor of American Studies at SUNY Buffalo. I teach a lot about women in work and comparative public policy. And I also serve on the board of an activist group in Buffalo called the Coalition for Economic Justice. And one of the things we're trying to do is win a living wage for workers who have contracts who work for the city in various ways, like workers whose employers have contracts with the city for more than $50,000 for employers and employees. And in Buffalo, the living wage movement in the U.S. is an attempt to get workers' wages up to at least the poverty level, and it varies by the location. So in some cities where it costs more to live, the living wage in that city is higher. In Buffalo, the cost of living is low, but we also have a living wage which only brings workers up to poverty level for a family of three. So it's a very modest living wage. Buffalo is one of the 39th city in the U.S. to adopt a living wage in 1999. Every attempt to implement that wage and to win that pay for workers has been fought by employers and has required lawsuits and other major efforts just to try to win or get the wage that these workers are entitled to, which they couldn't live on anyway, which would only be in Buffalo, poverty level for a family of three. So now it would be about $10 an hour without health care and with health care, and $11 an hour with health care. In recent years, we were very successful in winning a living wage that's called seasonal sanitation workers, guys who work on the garbage truck. They do the exact same job that full-time city employees do, but they earn a poverty level wage. It was about $6 or $7 an hour, and then it went up to $8 an hour. When they finally won the living wage, it was, they're up to $10 an hour. The only difference between them and the full-time workers is that the full-time workers have a full-time salary, benefits, vacation. These guys are seasonal because they get laid off for 1 week twice a year. And that's the way it works.
You know what? At the same time.
Yes, but they're not permanent, though, so they have to get laid off so they can be kept seasonal. Another group that we won the promise of a living wage for is the school buses. And they are the ones that ride the school buses and help the kids get to school in the morning. The board has won the promise of a living wage from the Board of Education. It's supposed to be phased in next year, 2010 to 2011. On the other hand, the city's having a huge budget crisis, and they're talking about layoffs rather than actually implementing the living wage. So something, we tried to get a living wage for new development that's supposed to occur in the city, and we actually got the city common council to pass something called a community benefits agreement, which would include a living wage. The first thing the business community said was, no, this is a non-starter. We are not going to pay workers who do the building or any other work in that new development a living wage. So it's been actually a much more controversial issue than we expected. And it's been an ongoing struggle to actually try to win something that has been passed into the law to actually happen in practice. So a few years ago, we were trying to win the living wage for the Board of Ed employees. I went to the schools and people said, well, where are the workers? And it turns out that the wages are so low. Most of these workers work two and three jobs. So I started to make a film about who are the workers that were shown, let them speak for themselves public meetings and attempt to tell their stories a little bit with some of my students. And this is a small grant from a media arts organization called Speaking Eel, and we made this short film to kind of tell you who the workers are and a little bit of the history of the William White Children in Buffalo. I'll just show you as much of the film as I have my share of time for, so whenever I get to the end of my 15 minutes, I'll just stop the film. But the film features four workers who've been working, fighting for a living wage, the seasonal sanitation workers, the school bus aides, the guy who worked for Rural Metro, the emergency ambulance service, and for my great surprise, almost everybody else who knows it, these folks who do the emergency medical work are not paid. Living wage, they're paid $7.65 an hour for pay, even though they work on average 60 hours a week. Many of them work longer. They go into harm's way. They save people's lives. And then a nurse's aide.
Thank you.
guys been a seasonal for 9 years.
Are there patterns to who gets hired for seasonal?
Well, and the full-time, people who go from seasonal to full-time usually know somebody, have a connection.
Thank you. about a series of strikes that happened in South Africa, in particular about a particular strike of public sector workers. The slideshow that you're going to see, it's not going to follow exactly what I'm talking about, but it's a slideshow of strikers' placards, and it's a strike that happened in 2007, which I was fortunate enough to be able to go through the whole strike, so to do it, to interview people over the course of the strike, and it was a strike of public sector workers. Fortunately, a very literate strike, so it was teachers, nurses, administrators, and hospital workers, which means that I've been able to keep this really amazing archive of placards that strikers made for themselves, which really reflect a version of events that sometimes takes up themes that were coming through in the official union statements, but presents them in a way that tells us a lot more about how people's heads are working when they're on strike, how we process information when we're in a conflict of the nature of this strike. Now, the strike was important in South Africa for two main reasons. In a bigger sense than just that it was an interesting strike of public sector workers. And the first one was that it brought the number of strike days in South Africa to a level that some people are saying is the biggest number of strikes ever in any year of South Africa's history. Prior to this strike, the most strike-prone year was 1987. That was still under the apartheid government. At the end of apartheid, the level of strikes started dropping off steadily until it reached a low point in about 2004. And that was partly because the union leaders, if you know anything about South Africa, COSATU, the main trade union federation, is in an alliance with the ruling party of the African National Congress, the ANC, and therefore there was this belief that with the end of apartheid that it was no longer necessary to go on strike for what you needed. You could simply speak to the government, negotiate with the alliance partners, and in that way achieve whatever it was that needed to change and so on. So this strike comes on the back of a rising level of strikes where things began to turn around 2005, partly because of news that after all these years of workers tightening their belts to try and make South Africa work, that company executives suddenly started announcing these giant increases for themselves, but were offering workers below inflation wage increases after 10 years of people having accepted these smaller and smaller increases every year. And it brought the number of strike days halfway through that year to 11 million strike days lost per person, which, as I say, is thought to be the biggest number of strikes ever in South Africa. And also, therefore, represents a resurgence of active striking. So in place of the idea of wage disputes being about the union negotiators sitting down and negotiating a three-year wage agreement on behalf of the members with absolutely no involvement of the members, you've got this development that suddenly things were starting to turn back to saying people are going to have to go on strike and actually be active in winning any increases that they get. The second reason that it was important, as I said earlier, this alliance between the unions and the ruling party had over the years become more and more of a one-way street as a means for the ruling party to discipline the unions without ever anything coming back from the government giving the unions what they were looking for. And this strike was part of a growing challenge on three main fronts to the dominance of President Thabo Mbeki, who is known in South Africa as an architect of a homegrown form of neoliberalism, and who really, he didn't really start it, but he gave it his name and tried to make the African National Congress proud of neoliberalism. And it came on three fronts, as I said. One was a growing strike wave. The second one was what we have called in South Africa the delivery protests, which first broke out in 2005, which were protests and demonstrations within townships, some of the poorest townships in South Africa, over distributional issues. And the first one was actually over the fact that in certain townships, people were still using a bucket toilet system. In other words, you didn't go to the toilet in a toilet, but in a bucket, which then had to be carried away and emptied somewhere. And what was happening was the local government elections were coming up. The ANC was once again saying, please vote for us, we're the best party. And people started to say, but where is the better life that you have been promising? And these very dramatic protests burst out, where people suddenly, out of a long period of quiet, just spread all over the country of people burning ties in the streets, steadily grew to a point where, in some cases, one case in Soweto where residents battled the police for a whole day until the police ran out of rubber bullets, and which were highly confrontational because the state responded immediately, just in the way the old apartheid state had responded with rubber bullets, tear gas, dogs, and so on. And then the third challenge that was going on was a challenge within the ANC where people within the African National Congress started to revolt and say, if you go on like this, Mbeki, we are actually going to lose all our legitimacy as an organisation. And that culminated in actually the defeat of Thabo Mbeki, who was thrown out of the ANC, deposed as president, and replaced by Jacob Zuma, who's our current president. Now, I think that actually things aren't finished yet. That whole revolt is actually still unfolding. It's taken a course along the way station. But in any case, this strike was a very important part of that. And you'll see themes of democracy, accountability, and what is the government doing for us is one of the themes that that appears here in these placards. Now, really, what my paper is about, I can email it to anyone who's interested afterwards, but really it's about looking at the dangers of judging consciousness of workers only on what you can see on the surface, only on what's visible and what's official. And also the dangers of seeing this as a static thing, as something that's fixed in time and that doesn't change. And it takes on a debate that unfolded at the time within the new social movements, by which I mean a series of movements that developed soon after apartheid, a minority, but the first minority to start questioning where the ANC was going after apartheid and whether it was really doing what it had promised to do. This debate started to develop about how should these movements relate to the trade unions and these strikes that were unfolding, which were still happening within the fold of the mainstream and the ANC and so on. And a comrade of mine by the name of Opale Irule put forward the argument that the strikes were meaningless to us. They were run-of-the-mill bureaucratic strikes. They weren't going to challenge the dominance of the ANC because the union leaderships were tied to the ANC. And he also argued that, in fact, the membership of the trade unions was actually had developed into a kind of labor aristocracy, that the unions were no longer representing the poor in any sense. They were representing this layer of upwardly mobile middle-class strikers, and therefore we should have nothing to do with it. We must concentrate on the delivery process. So this is the argument I take on, and in doing that, I'm crossing, in a way, between activists and academic theorizing. And if I can just explain briefly what do I mean by that. Someone called Colin Barker put it, Colin Barker and Judy Cox put it very well. They say that activist theorizing addresses different kinds of questions from social sciences. Questions that are geared towards strategic and tactical proposals. So in activist theorizing, you're looking for a complex proposition that links together a reading of the nature of the present situation with an action plan for the immediate future. So in other words, activist theorizing is not about saying, in a big sense, how does society work, even though that might be one of the effects of it, but it's about saying, what do we do, what is happening right now, and what is the potential that we can try to change the situation? Okay, if you want to make it much more practical, Leopold's strategic proposal in all the strikes concentrates on the distributional struggles. My strategic proposal is essentially that the strikes open up possibilities for starting to link the distributional struggles with the struggles over wages and for higher wages, such as this one that's going on. Now, this also leads me into a sort of The paper therefore has to deal with the kind of what if element, which is actually quite difficult to deal with, but I'll give you an example. There's an anecdote of this what if element was a meeting of health workers somewhere about three quarters of the way through this month-long strike, where people are gathered to discuss moving from the trade union leadership is coming along and saying, okay, you were demanding 12%, we're not winning 12%, we want to discuss with you that we can fall back to 8%. Okay, the meeting starts off with, as meetings in South Africa always do, the person on the platform shouts, Viva the Hawu, and everyone shouts, Viva! And then they shout this whole string, they'll be Viva South Africa Communist Party, Viva the Soweto Strike Committee, Viva, Viva, Viva, and one of the things that myself as an activist, I always listen since the end of apartheid, is when the person shouts, Viva ANC, how loud is the response? Because that gives me a sense how confident are people remaining in the ANC. Now, in this case, something happened that I've never seen before, and I've never seen it since. And what happened was the guy shouts, Viva, and everyone, Viva, Viva, Viva. Everyone's very loud, Viva ANC, and there's this moment of silence. And then one of the strikers, who's drunk, as it happens, shouts, Down with shit! And the meeting just like goes berserk. There's a little bit of an argument. The ANC never gets the Viva. Okay, now I've never seen that before, as I say, and it hasn't actually happened since. And as another activist put it, you can actually hear the audience thinking in that second, do we still support the ANC? Do we still want the ANC to live long? Now, the question really, the what-if element, is to try and explain why is it that you had this very momentous event happening behind the scenes, but within 9 days, the strike had been tied up in a very ordinary settlement of actually 7.5%, actually below the fallback position that the union leaders had come along to sell. And therefore, it seems as if the outcome that Nehruda is proposing, it seems as if he was right all along. The strikes were just bureaucratic run-of-the-mill strikes. There's nothing we can do to change the outcome. And they're just going to go on fitting in with the ruling party and never really challenging it. And in fact, a year later, after the strikes, what you see is that Thabo Mbeki is thrown out, again a momentous event, but he's replaced by Jacob Zuma, who really is in no way a champion of workers. And that's becoming clearer and clearer as things unfold, while the alliance apparently is still intact. So this big challenge to the alliance suddenly all evaporates by the end of the strike. And that's really what my paper has tried to understand, is how does this happen? How did this this challenge seemingly come to nothing within 5 days? Now, my argument is that it certainly is true that, as Lehukune said, the strikes were shaped by the perfectly normal rhythms of bureaucratic bargaining. Okay, they were coming out of that. But even though they were entirely procedural on the surface, underneath that, some very unprocedural possibilities had started to open up in the way strikers were seeing the world. And that's really the thing that he misses, and therefore, as an activist, misses the opportunity to actually shape the outcome towards something that could have been actually a lot more dramatic and a lot more changing of history. And it comes across very clearly in the interviews that I'm doing with strikers over the course of the strike, that on the one hand, you've got a very ordinary sectoral consciousness in the strike, okay, where everything that people are saying about government, you know, there's a conflict, a normal conflict between workers and the employer. In this case, the employer happens to be government, and therefore you hear a lot of stuff against the government. But because of that, and because of the politically explosive backdrop that the strikes were taking place against, my argument is that it actually started to poke a hole through to bring out these very contradictory views of government that actually became much more political and went beyond the sectoral nature of the strike. And you can see this in a number of ways. One is that there was, I'm going to start writing up now,
But one is that there's a number of new songs that start to develop within the strike. Now, in South Africa, no strike happens without a lot of singing and dancing, and that's one of the ways that people keep going. And people are always developing new songs as they go along, sometimes basing them on hymns and changing the words, sometimes developing them completely new. And one of these songs went by Kense Bakingwana, which means, referring to the government, they are making themselves gods. So in other words, it was a reflection that there's this growing sense of distance between strikers and the government, where they see that government is putting itself against the people who it pretends to be part of. And you get another theme that comes out a lot is the theme of, we put you where you are and look how you're treating us. Now this is a theme, it comes across in two ways. One is saying, we voted for you. And please remember who put you where you are, through the vote. So a more passive version of it. But there's another version that you would have seen in the placards talking about the health minister's liver, which is a version, what happened was the health minister who came out hard against the strikers actually was an alcoholic and had a liver transplant at some point. And some nurse pointed this out. And this was taken up immediately across the strike of people saying, well, what about the health minister's liver? And that really is a different kind of concept of power. That's modified voting, but that says, who is it that makes everything keep running in this world? Who is it that does all the work, that keeps you healthy, that teaches your children and so on? So these are things that are starting to come out. The other thing that comes out very clearly in the government is in the interviews, is a highly contradictory and ambiguous approach to government coming up, that people are feeling, yes, this is supposed to be our government, but at the same time, there's the beginnings of a break with that. And it comes out very clearly in one particular quote that I want to read you, where the striker actually, in the same interview, in the same 10 minutes, comes out with three different views of government. So she says, the government does not respect and does not care about its workers. During the strike, it was threatening essential workers. The government does not care for and doesn't appreciate or love its workers. Then she talks a little bit more, then she goes on, government is part of the workers. The problem is that it forgets where it comes from. She ends up with, we vote for the government, it's our government. Workers can't live or function without a government, and the government cannot function without workers. They need each other. Okay, so it's by no means the kind of unproblematic loyalty to government that someone like Nehru Gandhi was talking about, but actually a very much more contradictory view where all sorts of new possibilities were opening up, and also that there's a lot of shifting going on over the end of the strike. Now, basically, to wrap up the argument, my question, why does this kind of ambiguity disappear from the view by the end of the strike? And I would say, whereas Lehurule says it's because these people are middle class, they no longer have real problems, and therefore they just accommodate with the way things are. My argument would be that it was more about a lack of alternatives, that actually the strikers were extremely militant. They didn't want to give up on their 12%. And many people were actually in interviews starting to make a link between their own circumstances and the circumstances of the delivery protest, but because they didn't have any great ideas for how to win the strike, any great strategic ideas, they were actually left powerless. And therefore this possible change in loyalty, the possibility of actually seeing an alternative to simply falling in with what government was doing, starts to get replaced, that instead of striking and fighting for what you need to go beyond government, we need to simply change the government. And therefore, what Nehruli is doing with his argument that we as social movement activists shouldn't have intervened is actually making sure of that outcome, making it a foregone conclusion by failing to provide some bigger imagination, such as we could have provided, about a different way of doing things. So that's what I have to say. Thank you.
And my mother is in Turkey. Research about class consciousness as an interpretation and changing act of social life, the case of final workers in Turkey. Research in Turkey's Zonguldak city, the black region city, for north of Turkey. Introduction. This study is a sociological attempt to understand the levels of the class consciousness of mine workers in Turkey. The level of class consciousness of the mine workers in Turkey are looked through the man's conceptualization of class consciousness and its elements. While this study is primarily based on the class consciousness of working class in Turkey, this notion does not stand for an activity of cognition or action, which is a result of a particular case in the context of our study. Rather, the collective character of class consciousness is emphasized and taken as the starting point in order to understand the levels of class consciousness among the working class. It can be said that the collective character of class consciousness derives from the historicity of the experiences and also shapes the particular experiences of the working class. For this feature of class consciousness enables the workers to transform their life conditions. Therefore, regarding the unity of the objective and subjective conditions, class consciousness should be conceptualized as a dialectical process. In general, they use Marx distinctions and debates, basically class identity, class opposition, class totality, conception of an alternative society. First of all, there needs an identity from which a worker defines herself, himself as a working class and thinks that she or he play a distinctive role with the other workers in the productive process. There are classical debates and Marx's classical defines for this discussion. Generally, class identity and class opposition is the are important for this study. Sampling and findings. The sampling of this research is composed of 500 coal mine workers in Zonguldak. The primary data on which this study is based on are the questions and also workers' narratives in interviews obtained in questionnaires as well as interviews. The average of workers' age is 36. All the interviews were male workers, of course, due to the lack of female coal mine workers in Turkey.
I think in general in the world.
Most of the workers were reached through the trade unions, workers, coffee houses and networks among the workers. In the research, the first table, I think, first of all, workers were asked if they agreed that the workers constitute a different class in society. Agree, 49.2, and others. As it's illustrated in Table 1, about half of the interviewees consider themselves as a member of working class. On the other hand, the number of the workers who do not agree with that the workers constitute a different class in society is not negligible, since it constitutes one-third of the sample. In terms of understanding the class opposition, the second element of the class consciousness among the workers. They were asked about the interests of employers and workers. The main problematic of the class position is about the workers' perspective towards the position of capitalists and its representative in the place of working class. Table 2 is here. According to Table 2, more than half of the workers in the sample regards their own interests as the working people totally different from the interests of the employers. This table together can be concluded that more than half of the workers consider themselves as a part of a social class, while more than half of the workers think that there are opposite sides class to their own social class in terms of interest of social class. It can be suggested that since the workers have a concept of an opposition in terms of class interests, this concept might enable their identity to be empowered and emphasized. Within the context of this research, set questions are also designed to assess the workers' perception about class totality. As Table 3 shows, workers are asked about the main three distinctions that shape the society in which they live. According to Table 3, the most important distinction in Turkish society is between workers and employment. However, the ratio of the number of workers who think so is only 33% for the other responses. It cannot be suggested that they reflect a kind of class society in terms of perceiving the personal position and social structure as a group. Finally, the workers left the table. The workers were asked if they were in a search for an alternative society. Interesting idea. I prefer a social system for 8%, but socialism are a more fair system than capitalism. Interesting. Hi. For men, the real revolutionist consciousness is composed of the unity of these four elements. In addition, these four elements are linked to one another. Marxist perspective provides a theoretical base about that consciousness develops from the first element and then reaches the last one in a progressive way. However, this is not a linear progress, which means completing one step will forward working class to the other. Considering this, it cannot be said that the workers who perceive themselves as a member of a class or experience the oppositional interest among classes in production process will have a search for an alternative society. Rather than a linear process, as Mann also mentions, class consciousness should be taken as a developing and continuing. For this, class consciousness might develop in social life as well as in the factories, working places of working class factories. Working class is shaped in a wide sphere which includes economical, political, social, and cultural dynamics. So the development of class consciousness cannot be limited to the economic sphere and working places, but is to be taken as a process which is, has the same dynamics in which working class is shaped. In this context, it can be said that the class consciousness of working class in Turkey is in the development process. For this reason, the development of working class consciousness will depend on other dynamics and the change in economic, political, and cultural spheres.
This first time I presented this paper itself, it's still fairly rough, as you might see, so keep that in mind. It's the first time I've actually used a PowerPoint. I've resisted this whole time, and I finally succumbed to this. Interestingly, I didn't experience a terrible kind of biological reaction that I thought I did. And finally, this is actually the first work I've done on labor-related issues. So it's not my usual field of concentration. Let me first ask, because this is about a strike that occurred in a cookie factory in the Bronx, in the North Bronx, called Stella Doro. Who here, first of all, has heard of Stella Doro cookies? Just the cookies. Okay. And who among you guys heard of the Stella Doro strike itself? And those who raise your hands, are you all from either the New York area or the Northeast?
Yeah. Philadelphia.
Sorry?
Philadelphia.
Okay.
Upstate.
Okay, all right. So it's actually a strike that received a lot of attention locally, right? And had the potential, in respects, to get attention, I think, not only nationally, but perhaps even internationally, if some things would have turned out differently and if it had managed to connect to a growing labor movement which never quite developed. I want to say first that this is a paper about class formation, essentially, and class capacities. Okay, and when do workers develop the capacity to undertake militant action? Because these workers during the strike throughout displayed significant numbers of levels of militancy. I want to say a little something about what I mean by militancy. By militancy, I don't mean exclusively the most radical tactics. I just mean that during the strike, the workers relied heavily on direct action tactics. Okay, that doesn't mean that they, I don't mean by this that they neglected more formal legalistic channels, because they didn't, that was part of it as well. But the thing about the strike is that throughout, the workers themselves understood that that had to be combined, the more formal legalistic strategy had to be combined with militant action at the plant site itself, at rallies, marches, etc., that were going on throughout. So here's a couple of pictures that were very typical of what we saw. This one here is during one of the rallies that the workers, one of the, you know, periodically organized. And this is here during at the picket line itself at night. And the workers manned the picket lines throughout the whole 11 months, one of the worst winters that New York has seen recently. But they were always out on the picket line and not on the street. Why did I choose to write about this? Well, in a sense, it's this new anomaly, right, that we need to explain. In the past, the exceptionalism, right, of the U.S. that activists and scholars alike have grappled with has been the lack of militancy, the lack of a strong labor movement, and the lack of, for instance, the Labor Party, strong social democratic or more radical Labor Party. This includes a relatively high level of passivity or quiescence among workers. One of the kind of characteristics has been low levels of industrial activity, industrial action, right? So whereas in the past, this is what preoccupied folks, right? Things have kind of turned. And now when we actually see a strike, it becomes the exceptional event that needs, that requires explanation, right? So that's why I chose to do something about it. I should say, I was involved in the support work around the strike, which is why I decided to write on it. In terms of methodology, ideally, I could have done something far more ethnographic. I could have been kind of experiencing what the workers themselves were experiencing, not only during the strike, but the months and years leading up to the strike themselves, some kind of observation of the veteran, like Burboy did in his classic research. Right? I wasn't able to do that, so instead what I did is, picking up on cues that I had that I had seen throughout the actual strike when I was supporting the workers, I then set up 20 interviews, right, with workers across the whole spectrum in the plant to try to get a sense of what actually was going on inside the plant, on the shop floor, right, in the year, the month, leading up to this. So I want to talk about why this is, you know, this is such a puzzle. Well, okay, first of all, you know, this is a strike, again, that largely was predicated on direct militant action by the workers that lasted 11 months. We just don't see this in the U.S. anymore, right? We might have predicted that we would start seeing this again, beginning in 07, 08, as the recession kind of, set in. But it hasn't happened, other than the Republic windows and doors factory in Chicago, right? This has kind of been the next most militant action that we've seen workers undertake collectively. At least at the point when I was putting this together. Since then, there have been new developments. And as I said, you know, against all odds, in the most adverse circumstances, right? They embarked upon this strike. And throughout, I mean, as bitter as things got, as discouraging as they became after a while, in many respects, not one worker even thought about, this is what I'm told, crossing the picket line. Finally, as I said, you know, facing similar attacks and similar circumstances, workers in other analogous industries and firms have not staged any types of industrial action, right? So let me go a little further into some features of this puzzle. First of all, the workers at Celadoro, in many respects, might be considered some type of belonging to some type of a labor aristocracy. These are kind of like the last good manufacturing jobs that are still around in the Bronx. Workers get decent wages when compared to what a typical worker in the Bronx in the service sector makes. Good benefits packages, etc. Right? And so you wouldn't think that these would be the types, if we go by that, right? These would be the type of workers who would actually be able to mount this type of an action. At the same time, right, or perhaps even in contrast to this, it was a highly segmented labor force, the law on skill, gender, more than national lines, really immigration status lines, I should say. You know, on the one hand, you had highly skilled maintenance workers, mechanics, right? And then you had the bulk of the workforce, which were immigrant women, largely single mothers, right? Recently arrived, some didn't speak English yet, right? Who were employed in quote unquote unskilled positions, packing duty, table packers, right? Packing the cookies. These kinds of divisions themselves, you know, there's volumes written on how these types of divisions undermine solidarity and unity or collective action among, or the potential for collective action among workers, right? So here's an added thing that makes this something that really needs to be explained given this characteristic of the workers. Another thing that we should bring up is that the local leadership, right, really did not have an adequate strategy for this fight, much less a winning strategy, right? On the one hand, the local didn't oppose the strike, and sometimes even led the workers into the strike, right? But once they were on strike and things got tough, it was clear to everyone that the local leadership had no idea what to do, right? So that's another added feature of the puzzle. All of these things militate against sustained collective action, right, to the time that they displayed. Yeah?
Was it a wide strike, or was it... Was it a wildcat strike, or was it...
No. It was... No. Contract negotiations have come up, and they kind of exhausted all the possible avenues during the negotiations, and they decided to go on strike. It wasn't a wildcat strike. Furthermore, you know, that during the strike, during the time that they're actually engaged in this militant action, there's some... what some people might consider contradictory attitudes exhibited by the workers, right? So on the one hand, in the same breath, right, when they're talking to the megaphones, they're denouncing capitalism as an, you know, an unjust system. But at the same time, they're presenting themselves as very loyal workers, right? Loyal to this factory, loyal to this brand, right? Because they've been here, been there for decades, right? So these are all things that, when taken together, force us, you know, to dig a little deeper and try to find out what's going on. Here's a little brief history of both the factory and then the culmination in the strike as well. The factory was established in the 1930s by an immigrant family from Italy, from Trieste. And they actually ran the company all the way to 1992. It was considered a very successful local institution, right? You know, see on the other, I'm going to make some comments on the other side of both of these columns. During that period, a sort of patrimonial setup existed in the shop, where there were clientelistic relations between the workers and the owners. Right? And they were personally tied and kind of indebted to the owners. Most of the workers were Italian males who'd come over just like them from the same town, often. You know, no skills, no English, etc. A lot of Albanians, I have not quite figured that part out yet. Right? But then things started to change. There was a period I call the transnational corporation period, right? In 1992, the family, as they're known, sold the factory to Nabisco, which then in 2000 sold it to Kraft. Okay? During that time, right, things started to change considerably inside the plant and on the shop floor. Already, even before the transnational period, as I call it, in 1989 there was this kind of first fairly heated strike. Right, it eventually was resolved within 6 weeks, but the workers displayed this kind of contestation, right, that had never been seen inside at this particular factory. Then things continued to change. The demographics changed considerably. There was a new wave, migratory wave of workers who came in, who started getting the best jobs inside the plant. New immigrants from all over, really, European, South Asian, Latin American men who got the best jobs as mechanics and electricians in the maintenance department. Meanwhile, the unskilled labor force is changing as well. From Italian women, right, it's shifted to the Latin American, the Latina immigrant that I've already described earlier. Then in 2006, right, the factory was sold to Brinwood Partners, a private equity firm. Right, they're in the business of buying these low-performing plants and flipping them, right, getting above-average rates of return in a very short period of time, right. And that was, as we'll see later, a shock, right, to the system that had developed and been erected on the shop floor. And it almost immediately triggered this growing militancy among the worker. Eventually what happens when, they go on a strike in August of 2008, the strike lasts until July 2009, when the NLRB actually rules in favor of the workers. At that point, the new owners bring wood, what they say is, we're closing the factory in 3 months. They give the sufficient notice that the Warren Act requires, and in October, the plant is closed. Now, I'm going to make a particular argument about how these capacities developed for this type of action, right, and how this kind of class formation inside the plant developed. I'm going to say that the capacities for this type of militant action were linked to issues and conflicts with management rooted in the organization of production on the shop floor itself, right? And tied to shifts and balances in the internal balance of forces of the factory. Okay? I'm taking a very micro, kind of local approach to this. Further, I'm saying that the conflicts and this reshaping capacity, right, this renewed capacity, was related to something I'm going to call institutions and practices and cultures that were built around the actual organization of the production process itself. There have been all kinds of alternative explanations offered, right? And I'm going to go through them very quickly and just think why I think they don't actually, they're insufficient. And I'm trying to develop it. The first one is a very logical one. It just says, look, these guys went on workers simply because they were provoked. I mean, these draconian measures, unheard of, right, in the history of this factory, of course they're going to go on strike. Who wouldn't go on strike, right? And, what they were asking for instance, was a complete elimination of sick days, drastic reduction in vacation time, what amount to after 5 years, 25% cut in wages, and asking that the workers start paying initially 20% of the cost of their health care plans. And that was going to also grow in time. So some people say, look, Renee, you're talking about institutions, shop floor, there's nothing to do with that. It's, any normal worker would do faced with this assault. Another explanation that's been offered is that it's the particular makeup of these it's a Chilean. The demographic makeup, right, of these particular workers, just a good mix of workers who had been, some of them were political from their countries of origin, and they, rose to leadership positions, and that's why they were able to have the strike. Another one said, there's just a good labor community alliance where radical activists came in and supported, and that's what accounts for the strike. And finally, something I already mentioned, that the union leadership itself is instrumental. Well, I think these are all important factors. We shouldn't dismiss them, but they're insufficient, right? A lot of this stuff we see all over the place. I have an answer for each one, but I'll just be very brief. We see this everywhere, right? And if these were sufficient for strikes, we'd expect a huge strike wave happening right now in the States, and it's simply not happening, right? So these are necessary but insufficient explanations for the strike. So what I want to do is I want to bring, people say bring the state back in. Let's bring the factory back in, okay? Dominant approaches in the literature to worker struggles and militancy, right, stress outside factors, external to the site of production, right? And there's some, again, I don't have time, right? But they all share a concern with sources of power, right, not founded on the worker's productive function, but some kind of power they can leverage extra to the factory, from beyond the factory, alliances made, relational power, etc., right? there's good reason for this. I mean, workers' kind of ability to mount political power on top of their economic clout is naturally very limited and has been decreasing, right? But that, what I want to say is that we do not force activists and scholars to ignore the fact that they decided to go. We have to go back to scene to study what was going on in the case where we do have industrial action inside the plant at the site of production. So, you know, here's just some, I won't even talk about this, because essentially, one thing that's helpful is to know that, you know, Burrowboy had this idea of workers themselves helping constitute and reproduce certain institutions on the shop floor, right, which then ultimately leads to them consenting to their organization. In fact, they voluntarily reproduce the very same institutions on the shop floor that exploit them, right? It's not false consciousness, it's that they're actually participating very materially in these practices, right? But he thinks that these are very stable, enduring institutions, right? Upon which you build a hegemonic order inside of the factory, right? Others, like Fossen, say that, you know, management decisions to introduce new technologies kind of immediately and automatically elicit resistance and struggle from the workers, right? It's kind of two very kind of polar, right, explanations of what happens on the shop floor between workers and management, right? Neither of them are sufficient, but what I'm trying to do in this paper is bring them together. How does restructuring, right, aggressive restructuring by management affect these institutions themselves that in other circumstances or earlier had actually generated consent among workers? Okay? Refining the argument, right? Hegemonic regimes inside the factory aren't static. They're subject to pressures, right, that come from competition that businesses face, right? And they're vulnerable to these technological innovations that management introduces, right? Further, technological innovations test the adherence to these games, right, and the game rules that Burrowboy was talking about, upon which the hegemonic shop floor order is erected. Finally, when and if resistance does occur, often it's actually rooted in, it's founded on the very same institution which earlier produced hegemony and consent. Right? I've run out of time, I believe. But I'll just take, again, 1 minute to kind of describe how this happened at Stella Doro. Essentially, the maintenance workers, the mechanics, right, through the years of experience and through the kind of parameters of production and the nature of the existing technology, had managed to set up a status for themselves in the factory, right, that it was very hard for management to confront and to take that power away from them. Similarly, the table packers, through a series of battles around the attempted imposition of new technologies, had asserted their own status, and they had by force to be incorporated into this emerging hegemonic order on the shop floor, right? When Brimwood comes in, right, it represents a shock to these institutions. And the same institutions are still there, but realignments occur. Thanks to coordination between the different departments, or among the different departments on the shop floor, which are built, again, on these previously existing institutions which used to generate consent, but now the realignment leads to opposition to management. So what I want to say is that it's those factors themselves, that was a necessary kind of shift that was happening inside the factory, on the shop floor, right, which had to occur before these workers could undertake this type of action. What are some important implications? First of all, this is a very structural, right, or structuralist approach to what's happening in terms of worker formation on the shop floor. But it's a more dynamic, it's a non-determinist one, right? When you look at actually existing institutions and see how they play themselves out, given certain conflicts, given certain changes in circumstance, and in the local, micro-level circumstances. The other very important implication is that we see that capitalism itself, even when it's succeeding in reordering and restructuring production, right, with new technologies, new machinery itself, it creates new capacities among workers and opens up new avenues for struggle. Right? and who knows what we can expect. Perhaps, you know, there'll be other cases, firms, similar firms with similar kind of issues on the shop floor, which will generate the type of struggles we all hope will emerge in the U.S.
I feel like, you know, answering the question, because I think everyone, when they're under pressure, I think maybe it's because of Americans who doesn't have the culture of strikes, but everyone who's under pressure, one way or the other, even if it's restructuring, they're bound to be conflict, you know, and one way or the other, that's going to happen, and you're not answering that as well.
One way or the other, what's going to happen?
Strikes are going to happen, a lot of militants is going to happen, there's a lot of response that's going to happen, like, as you said, the cookies, because of the structuring of the Brainwood, there was a lot of conflict that happened there between workers and management. That is, I think, inedible, one way or the other, in various ways, especially when it's like extreme changes. I think sometimes it comes to that point where you have nothing else left but except to actually fight. But I think one of the things that that was interesting is like they stayed out of work from August until July. I just want to know how they survived that, and because I mean, like, one of the tactics I think most employers use is time. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like in South Africa, for example, where we had security fighting, and it lasted 3 months. And in that process, they had nothing to survive on. They had to go back and back and you know what I mean, and get to that level. So I just want to know about that. And as well, I think also you talk about the outside of as the push out. Also, you have to think about the outside and how it influences the micro level. I'm just wondering about the recession as well, and especially during that time when the strike happened, how that also could have been an influence or didn't. I'm not sure because I don't know the context in America in general, but I'm curious about that as well, the militancy that could have came because of that as well, in that process, and also because of the mechanisms were used at a particular, they were responding as the capitalist or the brain board was responding to a particular element, and they used certain structures to actually implement it. So I'm just curious about those actually two things, and you know what I mean, and how that fits into the picture, not necessarily,
Well, I mean, I didn't really get to the empirical part because, again, I genetically just talk too much. I'm programmed this way. But that would have helped kind of explain what was happening inside, what were these different shifts about, what were the measures that the new management tried to impose, and how did that differ from the times that the management under previous ownerships had tried similar things, right? So that would have given more, you know, meat to my presentation for you to grab onto. But, I mean, and so that would have been kind of offering that added element that I think helps explain this strike. Right? But going back to your earlier point, you used a word that I think we often, that often guides us, especially activists, right? These things, it's going to be inevitable. They're going to happen. You push workers hard enough, eventually they're going to fight back. Well, the U.S. is a terrible case. It demonstrates the exact opposite. Workers have been under assault since, you know, the late 70s, the mid-70s, perhaps. And now there's a renewed assault against workers. In fact, wages in New York City, during this time, 08-09, fell by 20%. Now, that seems astounding. A lot of that is accounted for by the falls in the wages of these financial executives. Right? But if you look at just manufacturing, just the types of production like that occurred in this factory, wages fell by somewhere between 8 and 9% in 1 year. Now that's an abrupt hit that workers took. You would have expected some fight back, right? If increased exploitation alone going to account for worker militancy, well, you know, New York, Chicago, I mean, all these, the U.S. would have erupted over the last couple of years, if not over the last two decades, right? So what I want to say is that this kind of macro class struggle, right, where increased levels of exploitation occur, that's just not enough. Class formation actually is based on the formation of capacities. And all I'm trying to say in this paper is that part of that capacity, right, is generated inside the plant at the site of production. We have to pay attention to that. You're absolutely right. External factors, the general political climate, the economic climate are very important. But if you just look at the economic climate, the recession and the growing unemployment should have, one would think, led to the opposite result. As you have a bunch of other workers lining up to take these jobs, you might think that under that pressure, these workers would have caved. And there's another, there are many more reasons to think that the workers would have caved over those 11 months, right? In fact, they were never able to halt production. Replacement workers, scouts were hired immediately and legally, as you can do in this country, right? So everything was working against them, yet they still went on strike.
But don't get this is
okay, awesome.
If I can just make a general point about the conference, I think it's reflected in the sense of the time. I think that the papers could benefit from discussing. I say why? Because in a sense, one's dealing with very different things. One's dealing with different methods of trying to find out what class consciousness is, understanding class formation in a very specific kind of way. So the question is, what are the different threads that run through the different cases? But one can get an understanding of class consciousness, class formation, and so on. So in the case of the film, for example, one might have wanted some follow-up, and I know you didn't have time in the film, but to, in a sense, pick up from these workers how they felt, not just about possibly the injustice that they feel in terms of their jobs, but what that means in terms of class, right? How they see themselves as moments of class. In your case, Claire, you know, we have a discussion of a union movement buttressed and moved around in different contexts through various forms of neoliberalism, getting rid of the decade, drawing upon the hope for the populist future through Jacob Zuman, as well as this process by which they have to deal with their political affiliations, the shift and change, which one would expect in a contradictory moment. So one's got class consciousness, but it's compounded, it's conflicted, it's compromised by the interpellations, we wish, of these different things. So I'm just making a general comment about, in a sense, the format of the panel. And all the papers are very interesting. And then the empirical questions around what does it mean to be a member of a class in the context of miners and so forth. Is there class formation? They're already formed as a class. That's not the issue. The issue is how they see themselves as a class. And there are broader questions around politics. So different things in your case. You know, Michael Burrow's work, as you probably know, he worked in Zambia, he worked in the Copperbelt. And one of the things he was interested in was the hidden mode of production, right? And how that comes to be formed in ways that these particular workers see themselves as classes. So this is why the cultural lens that he draws from in order to understand the specificity of these particular workers. So we're dealing with different things here. We're dealing with class consciousness in a moment of the destruction of a paternalistic patrimonial system, as you rightly point out, in the face of this attack upon workers at a given time. But again, when you talk about the formation of class, there's an open question about they've already been formed. You're not talking about their class consciousness, I assume, right?
Yeah, can I respond directly?
Yeah. Anyway, I'm just throwing this out because I think.
By class formation, I don't mean class structure. But of course, they've been formed, okay. Materially speaking, right? Okay. Production has thrown this class into existence as part of the class structure. Okay. When I say formation, I mean how it's organized politically, how it becomes a class for itself. Right?
Okay.
And so that involves consciousness, organization, strategy, etc.
Okay.
That's what I mean by
formation,
not structure.
Thank you, Wendy. I enjoy every paper, and I'm too.
Yeah, I'd like to just echo those comments that each of these presentations was great and very helpful. In terms of these Stegosaurus strikes, my guess is that they were able to survive because that local paid them strike benefits equivalent to their wages.
No, they got but there is something there. I mean, they got $100 stipend or whatever a week, but what they did get was unemployment benefits.
Right, after 5 weeks in the city?
Yeah, that's right. But even then, that goes back to your question. How did they endure this for so long? That's part of it. But I think it's clear and sufficient. I mean, if workers thought... And for them, considering the wages that they had kind of achieved until this point, it was a huge cut.
But I mean, what they were fighting for, literally, is that was probably one of the few unionized manufacturing jobs left in the Bronx and in the five boroughs. And the Bronx is one of the highest poverty counties in the entire country, so these guys were literally fighting for some of the few decent jobs.
And management constantly reminded them of this. Your neighbor makes $10 an hour at CVS or $8 at McDonald's. What are you complaining about? Right. However, look, there's a very interesting similar case with the Old London bakery shop, also in the Bronx, also unionized. It's a different union, but it's also unionized. Well, they're shuttering that plant as well without a peep from the workers. So that there's a very interesting contrast just right there. Yes.
I enjoyed all the presentations too, and it really brings home the international working class as a commonality. It's very moving, actually. I had a question for Claire. You're at the University of Johannesburg about your term activist theorizing. It's very interesting to me, and what I was curious about is if this is sort of a movement of a way of approaching things, is it just your term, if you could comment on it a little bit more?
I borrowed the term from Colin Barker and Judy Cott, who've been working amongst social movement theorizing. It's obviously an issue that's starting to come up as social movements have grown and more activists have been, as academics, getting involved in it. But also, we work in a unit, myself and also, which is trying to look at social change, and where most of us are wanting to not just study it, but do it. So I suppose that's where it comes in. You know, because I think, as I hinted at in the paper, there is that big difference in, you know, when you write an academic paper for a journal, the first thing they'll say is, well, what does this mean for theory? And I'm not anti-theoretical at all. I'm very much, you know, I think you need theory to grasp how to go forward as an activist, but there's that kind of difference that somehow academic journals want you to generalize hugely, and it seems to me more and more that the old phrase of Marx, you know, the philosophers interpreted, the point is to change things, and you can't always stop to theorize in a big sense when you're in the middle of something and trying to think, how do we win, how do we take it forward, how do we take the next step, you know. So I suppose it was out of that that I started to look at their work and try to grasp, you know, what is the difference between what I'm doing as an activist and what I'm expected to do for an academic journal, you know, to try and get around the academic journals going, you know, you can't publish this because it's not theoretical enough, to try and deal with that. Having said that, I think there's also general propositions, as that word, that do come out of this, and one of them, you know, the implications for theory, the very obvious ones that you know, people's ideas change in response to the circumstances that they're in, and also that it's not, you know, the ideas that people have, and this seems to be coming out as well in what you were talking about, it's not, consciousness is very seldom an either or, that you're all revolutionary or all conservative or whatever, you know, but that actually it's a thing where people can have two or three completely contradicting ideas in your head at one time. we all experience that, but I suppose the issue for activists is how do we sort of build the confidence of particular ideas, or to encourage people to start questioning the contradictions that are coming up as we face the real world that we live in. So going from, destroy capitalism, but at the same time we're loyal workers. And that's something very much in the public sector strike. One of the marvelous contradictions about it was that people were saying, this is a set of people who in South Africa are supposed to, since the 80s, have been understood to be middle class teachers and nurses. Okay? Even way back during the time of apartheid, if you were a teacher or a nurse, you could consider yourself middle class. And what people were saying is, we don't get paid enough to be middle class. So coming from this quite, a sort of idea of I'm not working class, I'm actually working class, middle class, but then beginning to do a very working class action as a result of it, and that's, now that's something you can academicize about for a long time, but for us the question of what we do about this to actually build a resistance, so I don't know if that gets anywhere, but I can recommend reading the stuff, because I found it really useful in standing up for an activist theorizing against academia.
I'm personally interested in the civil society in the South African situation. For many of us in the rest of Africa, South Africa will have really a lot of experience in the society and the Communist Party, and also for many of us. But the South African job is very complex. Even the processes that led to independence in 1994. A lot of compromises here and there. I'm not too sure if some of the alliance partners were aware of that ability to complicate the nature of those negotiations. And that has affected the relationship between the ANC and COSATU, for instance. And very soon after, here, the growth economic result and the other one. But about 3 years after the
Independence.
Yeah. In fact the joke was that the also was in the revival chair. And that was a reflection of the failure of the international community on internal banking government. Now, for me, we are talking of workers' action and class consciousness. And the measure of the consciousness of workers will be reflected in the type of action they take in response to the policies. It doesn't matter how we classify them. For instance, do you, for the sake of old relationships, continue to tolerate the dominance of authority? Remember at the point, the COSATU was looking for new partners, and at the point, they were having alliances with some religious organizations outside the transatlantic alliance. And for me, as activist scholars, that's where I categorize those of us who are in this meeting. It helps if we can assist the working class and the organizations to have a proper understanding of issues. In case of the men workers of Turkey, for instance, there were two questions that were asked. One whether they prefer socialism, the other whether they like a fairer system. More people said they like a fairer system. And the next one, okay, you can then argue that the social society is just a fair alternative. At times, we don't understand our own concepts, but if you put these things to reflect their everyday experiences, oh, is that what you mean? Let me just say.
I think we have to take into account those options, or what's the other way around? I mean, we understand things because the workers
do what they do.
Yeah, and you know, often, I would say way more often, they get a lot better than scholars. At least that's my observation.
I would comment that, and I think it's been true of other sessions as well, and maybe we can all pass it on, that for some of the centers, it would be good to have scholars. It's some way of kind of connecting the pieces. Because I was struck by where, sort of where consciousness lay across the, I didn't, in fact, I got the link to the film, but across the three papers that I heard. Well, one, if it existed, it was outside there in the kind of larger setting. For another, it was on, it was being described, it was what state police were calling it, sort of, you know, picket line education. People can be radicalized, consciousness grows in each bound, but you're suddenly faced against a very strong force, which is what happened. You sort of see what your employers are about. And then, as you said, it's sort of like things that are actually happening in the workplace. That's where the activities come from. And that to me is sort of, you know, it's an interesting sort of way of having to think about, you know, what consciousness is. It's certainly not fully formed. It's certainly sort of riddled with contradictions. And yet, it's key to how we continually try to think about, under what conditions and with what capacities do people push back, and including I think most of us in this room, at least a lot of us, are aware that our workplaces are likely to be under a kind of wage assault that you've been talking about.
See, I've been a dentist having discussions. People who come in and read all the papers and say, this is the way you should be receiving it. If we had discussed this, you wouldn't have had enough time to talk. All of us wouldn't have had enough time to talk. And one of the coordinators of the conference, as one of the coordinators of the conference, I can tell you, we thought about having discussions. And we went against it because in the past we received criticism for not having enough time to discuss it. So either you get to discuss it, who tells you what you should know or the way you should have heard these papers, or you do it yourself. And I was challenged myself very much, because this is not, I'm not a social scientist. I was challenged to try to put these together. You helped me out tremendously. You helped me out tremendously. And so I had many discussions instead of one. Just an idea.
Okay.
I hope that this morning Mike's wife said that he will publish the papers on the conference website that the speakers send him. Papers, so I hope all the speakers of this session send your papers, because I would like to read all of them. And I just had a specific question on the Turkey, wine workers in Turkey. Were they represented by a union? And if so, were they unionized wine workers? And if so, which federation were they in? The Main Street, the leftist, or the Islamic?
Union,
I mean,
it's workers. Turkish Federation.
Okay, the mainstream.
Yeah, Turkish. General Maden İşçileri Federasyonu in Turkish. General Mine Workers Trade Union is affiliated to Turkish. Turkish Confederation. In Turkish, two of Mine Workers Trade Union. Different two Mine Workers Trade Union in Turkish. One of is different, one of them is different, it's political, little political. In one of the center is in Zonguldak, this study city, which of is more left than other. The other one is also affiliated by Turkish Confederation, but more writer, right for the wings than global like trade union.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You might have said this in the beginning, but what is the target of mine workers?
It is not my research, but our friend's research about mine workers, class consciousness as an interpretation and changing act of social life. The case of the mine workers in Turkey, the research Zonguldak, Turkey, north of Turkey, with 500.
Yes, but why miners? Why not? Cookie maker.
Our friends focus on strikes generally. In 1989, in Turkey, the biggest strike maybe in Turkey have been seen. I mean, Turkish people seen. But after this, after 20 years, and he want to see again, he want to look again the same place.
I understand. Thank you.
I think I could help you with your Albanians. My guess is that they didn't immigrate directly from Albania. They were in Italy first,
yeah,
and then came to Albania. I mean, I came to the United States. And this is the first.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, but I didn't get how. Thanks for that. They're not around anymore.
No.
I'm saying these workers. There are one or two of the old Italian folks still around.
Still.
But none of the old Albanians around. That's very awesome. Thank you.
On your way out, there's some free literature on the table about this media arts organization, Speaky Wheel in Buffalo, that sponsored this film and other films. And I also have DVDs for sale for $10, which has not only my film Around the Clock, but a really terrific film on Native American boarding schools and on independent day housing, grassroots efforts to play housing in Buffalo. So if you're interested, have that. Thank you all.
Thank you.